Chapter 9. And I just wanted to thank very much, in case we don't get to do it later, to thank Trish and Gail, who came up yesterday and set up all these tables and made the church look so beautiful for our Christmas lunch today. And they've done a lot of work for organising our lunch today. So could we express our appreciation? And so today we are continuing our little series on Isaiah chapter 9, looking at the beautiful promise of the Saviour's coming, written some 900 years before, about 700 years before the birth of Jesus. Now, my wife, Amanda Sue, has a chihuahua, and the chihuahua's name is Max, and it happens that Max and I live in the same house. And sometimes I observe little Max and I notice that he's a very edgy little dog. And I notice that even when his eyes are shut and he looks like he's asleep, that his ears are up and they're actually listening for every sound within a 5 kilometre radius of our house. And if there is a strange sound, then I notice that even though his eyes are shut, he gives a little growl. And if he detects that that strange sound is quite close to our house, then up he leaps, and he runs to the door, and he barks. Now, I'm not exactly sure what he thinks he's going to achieve by this barking, because I fail to see an intruder saying, "Oh my goodness, I can hear a chihuahua in that house. I better keep clear." I don't think it's going to achieve that. But what we see with little Max is that there are he senses threats, you see. There are threats to his house, to his family. And when he feels threatened, he gets afraid. He fears. And fear turns to anger. And he starts to bark. And here in Isaiah 9, these words were written to a people who felt threatened. Isaiah was writing to the nation of Judah in the 8th century BC, and the nation of Judah was looking to the north and they could see the Assyrian Empire, which was a very brutal empire, was starting to become very powerful, and the Assyrian soldiers were starting to move to the south. And the villages of Judah, the outskirts, were starting to be threatened. And the people of Judah, feeling threatened, they started to respond with fear. Threat turned them to fear. And fear made them angry. We saw that last week, how their fears for the future were making them angry. And fear led them to despair as well. And they wondered, is God really there? Is God really looking after us? And they began to shake their fist at God and to say, "Where are you, God? We feel threatened. Where are you? What are you doing?" And we see that these words written to the people of Judah who were feeling threatened apply just as much to us in the 21st century in Australia. They apply very, very much to us as God's church in the 21st century. Because we might be feeling threatened. And I talk to many of you, and I talk to many Christians in the wider church community, and many are feeling threatened. The marriage laws have been changed. Anti-discrimination laws are sitting there ready to prosecute those who don't get with the new program. And there's a threat to our schools, and there's a threat to our families, and there's a threat to Christians in the workplace. And many in the community, the Christian community, are starting to feel threatened. And all too often we are seeing those who are feeling threatened start to become angry. And it's expressing itself in anger. And it's expressing itself in fear. And it's expressing itself even sometimes in despair. Where is God in all of this? So can you see how these beautiful words, which were written to a threatened nation in the 8th century BC, threatened, fearful, angry, despairing apply very much to us in the 21st century as we feel the distant threats. Again, threats to our churches, threats to our Christians in the workplace, on campus, and even in our own homes. So let's see what God is saying to those who feel threatened and fearful. And we saw last week from Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, these beautiful words. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us, here's the reason why the people of Judah did not need to feel afraid. For to us, a child is born. To us, a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And last week we saw that God's people don't need to feel afraid because God has sent his son, born in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago, and that the government, God has placed the government on his shoulders. What does that mean? It means not that he just props up the world and all that's happening in the world, but that he is taking it in the direction he wants to take it. The future is in his hands. The government is on his shoulders. Things are going the way he wants them to go. And so to a people who are feeling afraid of the future, God is saying, don't feel afraid of the future. The future is on the shoulders of my son, Jesus Christ. And we can rejoice at that. And we can have great peace because of that. But the question that the original readers might then have had is, okay, God, you're sending us a new king. We can see that. And the government is on his shoulders. We can see that. But what is the character of this king? What is this king like? Because the people of Israel and Judah had seen many bad kings, hadn't they? They'd seen kings like Saul, who disobeyed God, who didn't respect God's laws, who was impatient, and who finished his life seeking the counsel of a necromancer. Even the best of the kings, like David, were deeply flawed. And so the question was, God, if the government is on the shoulders of your son, the future is in his hands, then what is he like? What's his character? Because we've seen many bad kings and they've led us down many bad paths. What's the character of your son? And we see that question answered in these four magnificent titles given to God's son, Jesus Christ, 700 years before his birth, that he would be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. Let's look at those briefly. The character of God's son, God's king. He would be a wonderful counselor. And that word wonderful, it means astonishing. It's the word that the people of Israel used after God had taken them through the Red Sea. Remember that? Remember that? The Exodus, where God parted the Red Sea and he took his people through and they sang a song and they said, God, you are astonishing. Your power is astonishing. And so God's king, on whose shoulders the government would be placed, would be not just a counselor, but a wonderful counselor. His counsel would be astonishing. Why? The reason is this. Human counselors don't know everything, do they? Far from it. Human counselors only have a little bit of information about what is happening right in front of their faces. God's counselor, Jesus, would know all things, past, present, and future. He would know exactly what is to come because he is bringing about that future. And the fact that Jesus is a wonderful counselor, an astonishing counselor, reminds us also that the kinds of things that Jesus says to us are often deeply surprising, even counterintuitive. Do you remember that time that Jesus was at the temple with his disciples? And do you remember they were watching all the people bring in their money to put it in the temple treasury? Remember that? And there are these rich people pouring in their bags of gold into the temple treasury. And then this woman comes in, this poor woman, poverty-stricken, a widow. And all she puts in the treasury are the two smallest coins in the nation of Israel, the mite, a fraction of a cent. And she puts that in the treasury. And Jesus says, you know what? Of all the people that have given today, she has given the most. And that's surprising, you see. Who would have known that except for the wonderful counselor? She's given most because they've given from their surplus. She has given all she had. He's the wonderful counselor. He says things that surprise us. Remember when he took his people to the mountain and he preached to them on the mountaintop. And he said, you know who the blessed people are? Do you know who the happy people are? You know who the people are that we should be most congratulating? He says they are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn, he said. Blessed are the meek, he said. Who would have expected this? Completely counterintuitive. No wise person from the world would ever have said such things. He is the wonderful counselor. And he is the one who can show us how our sins can be forgiven and how we can find eternal life and peace with God. That's the character of God's King, the wonderful counselor. And then he is the mighty God. And Isaiah just comes out and says, That child who's going to be born centuries ahead, he will be God. God come down. God taking on flesh. God born into this world. He said it back in Isaiah chapter 7, didn't he? He said he will be called Emmanuel, God with us. But not just God, mighty God. And the word mighty is a wonderful word. It describes in the books of Samuel, it describes David's mighty men. Now, who does not love that chapter about David's mighty men in 2 Samuel? I think it's about chapter 22. It's so wonderful. Now, look, I was a child of was born in 1970, so I started watching movies in the 80s, which means I was exposed to all the great action heroes, right, in the 80s. Arnold Schwarzenegger. Who remembers him? Sylvester Stallone. Bruce Willis. And I think Clint Eastwood was getting a bit old by then, wasn't he, in the 1980s. But these were the mighty men, right? These were the mighty men in the 1980s. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis, Sylvester Stallone. Well, if you'd pitted one of those guys up against one of David's mighty men, it would not have been any contest at all. You know, these guys were like kittens compared to David's mighty men. And we read about David's mighty men, that they could take on hundreds of enemy soldiers single-handed. These are the mighty men who fought for David in his campaigns. And it's the same word used to describe Jesus here. Mighty God. Not just God, but God come to fight for his people. God come to destroy sin, to destroy evil in the world, to bring about good. And how would he fight? How would God's mighty man defeat sin and evil for his people, not with a sword, but by giving his life as a ransom, by giving his life on the cross. He defeated God's enemies, the enemies of God's people, by dying for them. And we must never forget, as we celebrate the birth of Jesus, we must never forget that he was born to die. Mighty God, come to fight on behalf of God's people, but destroying evil for us by dying in our place on the cross. The third descriptor, everlasting Father. It's very beautiful. Again, it's very surprising. How could you don't think of a baby as a father, a child as a father, but Isaiah knew that this child would be a father to God's people. And don't forget, in Israel, fathers were notorious for their tenderness to their children. And remember when Jesus told that parable of the prodigal son. And he told a story that would resonate with people. They'd seen this kind of fathering going on. Remember the parable? The younger son taking all his inheritance, money that had been earned over decades, money that had been earned at great sacrifice. He takes all this money, he goes to a foreign land, and he blows it all on wine, women, and song. And he wastes his inheritance and all this money that had been given to him, and until the point where he has no food left to eat. And he says, I'll go back to my father and I'll apologize. And I'll say, please make me a servant in your household. But how does the story go? When he was at a great distance, the father saw him. Why is that? Why did the father see his son coming at a great distance? Why is that? It's because he was looking for him. He was longing for him to return. He was out on the road. Is my son going to come back today? This is the kind of father that the people in Israel had seen. And when his son came, he ran to him and embraces him, forgives him, and throws a party for him. This is the kind of father that God is. He's tender. He's forgiving. He's very patient. He's affectionate. He's loving. And when Isaiah said, my son is coming to rule, he will be like a father to you. He will love you. He'll be tender. He will carry you. And he will be an everlasting father, consistent. He will never stop caring for you in that way. And then that final title for Jesus, what is it? The Prince of Peace. Prince of Peace. Peace in Israel. What's the word? Shalom. The Jewish word shalom. It doesn't just mean an absence of war. It means positive blessings, abundance, prosperity, plenty. That's why Jewish people to this day greet each other with shalom. You're not just saying g'day. You're saying, may all God's prosperity and abundance rest on you. It's a beautiful greeting. And God said that his son would be the Prince of Peace. He would be the one who would bring peace to his people. World War I, they said, was the war to end all wars. And we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the end of that war next year. And it wasn't the end of all wars. You look at the 20th century, it was just the start of a century of dreadful war. And they brought in the League of Nations in 1920, and they thought this is going to solve the problem. This is going to bring the nations together, and there won't be any more war. We saw how long that lasted. World War II, 1939 to 1945. And then they said, well, this has got to be it. Now we'll have the United Nations, and this will bring peace to the earth. And it hasn't. Humanity constantly at war, constantly struggling and striving with one another. You see, what humanity needs is not an authority, a human authority, that tries to impose peace on the earth. What humanity needs are peaceful hearts, new hearts, hearts that are not selfish, hearts that are not trying to get ourselves on top of the other person and take what belongs to them and to impose ourselves on others. And this is what the Prince of Peace brings, because he brings peace to our hearts, to humanity, frustrated, tired, selfish, never content. You come to Christ and he brings that peace. He brings peace to our hearts. He's the Prince of Peace. What a beautiful passage. What God is saying to you this morning is, when you see the threats coming, don't flee into fear, but flee to his Son. Flee to Emmanuel, God with us. Flee to the one on whom God has placed the government. The government has been placed on his shoulders. Flee to the one who is the wonderful counselor, the mighty God, the everlasting Father, and the Prince of Peace. And our prayer this Christmas is that if you don't know this wonderful person, Jesus Christ, God's Son, who was given to us, our prayer, our sincere prayer, is that you will come to know him. And if you want to know more about him, please come and talk to me. Come and talk to one of the elders, or the wives of the elders. Come and talk to Christiani, our women's worker, the deacons. Come and talk to us, and we would love to tell you more about how you can know more about God's Son, Jesus Christ. Well, before we eat together, we're going to stand and sing our final song. It's a beauty. It's a Christmas song we all know well. Let's stand and rejoice together.